working with, and we really are taking our lead from these students now. Then they're in the forefront, and through social media, their voices are being heard, and we're right there with them.
Excellent. All right, excellent. Okay, Carol.
Good morning. I'm Carol Brown, president of the West Haven Black Coalition. Yes, I'm a self-made leader, formed a self-made organization, and I come from the NAACP, 68 years as a member of the NAACP, even though I'm only 39, Dory.
I'm 39, Carol. I've known you a long time. Just saying.
What is happening this morning here at the station needs to be taken around the state.
Yeah.
And I live in the most racist city other than Waterbury, in this state, and that's West Haven, Connecticut. It's like living in Mississippi 1922. It is full of racism, and when I talk about racism, for me, I was raised in a home where my father didn't allow us to write on white paper, where we didn't have white walls, where we didn't eat vanilla ice cream. My father taught us to be racist. But by the time we moved to Seattle, Washington, and I had the opportunity to meet Asians and live next door and across the street from people that didn't look like me, I developed a different attitude. But as a grown-up, I live in a city that's made me always realize that it is not about me until my people are free. We may have the opportunity to move forward as individuals, but unless all of us are able to move forward, we need to keep this fight going. And what thrills me now is knowing that the young people are stepping up because they feel we have not done what we should have been doing. They know that they have many of us who have sold out just to get a cookie.
A crumb.
Or a crown. I live in a town where that has been practiced. It was my people in West Haven that turned on me because I was making all the wrong decisions, saying all the wrong things, telling them like it is, calling them out at meetings. In West Haven in 2015, we don't even have an African American on the school board. And do you know what West Haven looks like now? It is an urban city. When I tried 48 hours ago to find emergency housing for a couple that needed it, we don't have social service agencies in West Haven. Nope. This conversation that we're having today, you need to invite leadership from West Haven and watch what you get. Watch what you get.
Interesting.
Now, they'll bring you black leaders that they call black leaders. But if you come to West Haven, and I say this very, very strongly, when you come to West Haven, yeah, that is my town. They want me to move. They think when I go and visit my city, Seattle, Washington, that when I go to visit that perhaps I'll stay. No. No, I don't stay. I am a 73-year-old woman that has more energy than some 25-year-olds.
That is
it's
true.
It's all about staying young thinking. It's all about recruiting these young people to do what I'm watching them do on television, what I'm watching them do in New Haven. You young people are tomorrow's future leaders. You are doing the right thing. But you need to know that if you march, we are going to be standing there alongside of you. We don't need to take over what you're doing. We need to push you through that door and say we are here with you and for you. It is not about us. We have to stop our generation from selling out for a crumb. We have to do that. You have sat and watched all of us, and you see there has been no movement. No movement at all. When I think about a Malik Jones, where Emma won her case, and she didn't get a penny for it, and the man who shot her son was promoted in that department.
Yep.
We cannot sit quietly any longer. WYBC, you're doing the right thing. Yeah. You need to bring every city into this station. Do your electric drum from a city like West Haven needs to be here. Waterbury needs to be here. But you need to realize who you're bringing to the table. When you come to West Haven, you don't come to West Haven without telling me, because you're not going to bring Uncle Tom's on this station. So I thank you for inviting me to be a part of this panel. The West Haven Black Coalition should be working alongside of Dory Dumas and the NAACP, because in the University of New Haven, that campus looks pretty white. That campus looks pretty white. They do have a black student union, but we need to let them know. Years ago, they fired two admissions directors, and we marched on that campus. So, Dory, I want you to know the coalition will walk with you, stay with you, visit colleges with you. We will be a team. We're here for the community.
Thank you, Carol.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow, you had me fall, Carol.
Good luck.
Well, I grew up in West Haven and in the same neighborhood as you, Carol. And my mom taught me long ago that you judge people one person at a time.
Mm.
You know, I've heard a lot of conversations today about ignorance. Not ignorance, education. And the word missing is ignorance. Intolerance. Yusuf, I was happy to hear you say that when your daughter brought home a white man, you changed.
Yeah.
You know, that was because of a personal interaction, a one-on-one decision.
Yep.
That you experienced, and it changed your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is all about. We can talk about all the institutional racism in the world. We can talk about our institutions, whether they're our police departments, our governments. And all of that, it's so overwhelming, you can feel that you're overwhelmed and you can't make a difference. But everyone can. And it starts at home. It starts with our parents teaching us and us teaching our children to judge each person and each interaction by the quality of that interaction. We talked about being colorblind before. Mm-hmm. And he was right. You do see color. But are you in tune enough and impassioned enough to see beyond that, to see what's next?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been fortunate enough in my life to be able to have a parent that pushed me to be my best. Mm-hmm. And you're all parents in this room, and you're pushing your children to be the best. Mm-hmm. But are we teaching them to look beyond the color of somebody's skin, their sexual orientation?
Mm-hmm.
Their political beliefs, their religious backgrounds. That's how we move the needle. You know, you unravel the system by pulling on a string and continuing to pull on that string one thread at a time. And then before you know it, you've made a difference. I applaud the passion in the room. I applaud the work that everyone's done. Carol, the work that you've done in West Haven. But the differences are happening one by one. Mm-hmm. I'm fortunate now to work for an organization that fosters the diversity in the conversations. We just had an event back. I work for Frontier Communications, and to be candid, we had a leadership night where we brought in folks of color, and we brought food in early on to kind of experience the different types and flavors of the folks that had working for us.
Yeah.
And then follow that up with conversations about how do we engage our workplace to be more inclusive? You know, we've been a proud sponsor of the Connecticut Forum on Racism, and we're sending a number of our employees up there to be part of that and to contribute. Conversations one by one, interactions one by one, learning to appreciate each other for who we are, not for what we're not. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to make the change.
All right.
And he does have power, and if anybody wants, got people that need work, he can get some people up here.
And we are hiring one, and I appreciate you telling me that.
Yeah, so let's get some jobs. Right? You know, we like to bring in some other folks to speak. Kristen, we have Kristen Rawls here with us. She's a student and a member of our community. You know, and also we got Kevin Walton, of course, Coach Walton over at Cross. He better win the championship this year. And we got We have Clifton Graves here with us. Tony?
Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, Tony. Can you also get over there for us? Tony Alivato, he's one of my DJs. Disco Tony. All right. So, all right. Let's move forward.
Okay, Jamal, you had a brief comment.
Just a quick comment, I want to point this out. It's a really radical assertion, but the idea that the most racist act that a black person can commit is killing another black person. So I know that that sounds crazy, right? But the fact is that one of the things we need to look at is that perhaps the murder, the ability for us to kill the reflections of ourselves, happens to come down because of the system of global white supremacy that gets us to the point where we devalue ourselves enough that we can be desensitized to killing somebody that looks just like us. I want to challenge the way we're thinking because we're so invested in the white-black thing. But there's a part of this that trickles down into the bedrock of our community, onto Dixwell and Bassett, right there, okay, where we are looking at each other and we're committing the most racist act that you could ever commit. We're doing the work of the KKK. They don't have to wear the sheets. They don't have to put on the badges because we're there to do the work for them. The residual impacts of global white supremacy people, we need to talk about that.
All right. Brother Kevin?
Well, I think my brother has spoken and he said a lot of the things I've been thinking today. But I think it's no coincidence that, you know, we've seen this, it's been ramped up since Barack Obama has taken office. And I think those who practice white supremacy are feeling that they're losing a grip on this country and this world. Actually, it's not true, but in their perception. And that's not to let them off the hook. That's just my perception. Someone who kind of studies this. As yourself, brother, I grew up in New York, so I remember those things. Yousef Hawkins, and I grew up in Staten Island where Eric Garner was killed. I grew up 10 minutes from there, and so it's no surprise that he lost his life to the hands of a racist New York City police officer because I've experienced it all my life growing up in New York City. What I want to talk about is this systemic racism. I think that's what it comes down to. Tony, I think it is. I think you spoke about breaking down walls one conversation at a time. But I often find myself saying, why is it us as black people have to be the ones to kind of extend that hand, to be expected? I'm not saying you said that. What I'm saying is the conversations I've had all the time, the ones to be expected to kind of extend that olive branch and the ones to turn the other cheek. I think the attorney said that we should be patient. No, I can't tell my 19-year-old son if he gets pulled over by the cops to be patient. I can't be patient as a parent. You understand what I'm saying? So we need those changes now. You know, you say we got some laws that say they're going to excessive force. Well, are we going to change the laws? Who's going to prosecute them? Right? Is it going to be the same prosecutor that prosecutes these same police officers, just like in Ferguson, so they walk? So I think there's a whole lot of things that we need to do with the NAACP. But talking about in the positions of power, right? I work at ACES in human resources, so I have a little bit of power. What is my power? Is that I can see who we bring in, who can do the hiring. But when you talk about hiring, people hire who looks like them. So we need people at the top who are going to be able to make decisions about who they hire, bring into these organizations. One of the things I do, I recruit teachers of color. It's a struggle. 93% of the teachers in American public schools are white. 7% are minority, and that's all minorities, black, Asian, Latino. So you think about that. And more than half the population of public school students are of color. So we're teaching them a Eurocentric history opposed to Afrocentric, Latino, Caribbean, and that's how it plays itself out, okay? So I have a 15-year-old son who just went to Atlanta on a civil rights trip. They left the trip calling him the professor. Why? Because he knew a lot of those things. Questions, asking questions. We tell him, question everything, son. Question why we only talk about slavery in our history books. Why when it, you know, they had someone ask if one of my fraternity brothers could come speak at one of the universities. And I said, do us a favor. Ask them any month other than February. Why? Because that's when Black History Month, so we're going to bring everybody in to talk about Black history and things of that nature. So I think it's systemic, right? Bank, financial institutions. When we're talking about why we had a financial collapse. Well, they're giving all these loans to people who can't afford them and things of that nature. Now we're foreclosing on houses. So when you saw Ferguson, Baltimore with the riots, you see those row houses and you talk about the red line and the things of that nature that happened. We don't talk about that stuff. When you talk about, we talked about police brutality and things. It's not just about police brutality. It's about who's policing these communities. Right. If you live in this community and my belief is this, and I'm talking really quick, so I want to give everybody else a chance. But you think about back Board versus Brown of Education, when we had over a million teachers displaced after they integrated the school system. Right. It's the same thing with policing. When you in this community, if you live in this community, you police this community, you're going to police this community differently. But if you police this community and then you travel back out to your suburb and you come back in and your only thought of black people before you get into this position is you see us in rap videos, you see us leading the news with the perp walks and things of that nature. If your only interaction with black folks is through TV, then you're going to come in with that mindset. You know. And I hate the fact that we have to sit here and justify the fact that we have tons of talented people of color in this city, in fact, in this room right now,
right,
that need the opportunity. But we're not no longer asking for opportunity. As you see, and I'm telling you, America's greatest fear is happening. It happened at the University of Missouri.
That's right.
Right? And here's the key. You might think I'm crazy. Here's the key. These African-American athletes at these major colleges, you imagine today, Ohio State University is playing Michigan State tonight. Can you imagine if those kids from Ohio State and Michigan State said, we're not playing tonight until you change, blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah, by the way, we need compensation because athletics, especially college athletics, is the new slavery.
Mm.
Professional athletes, what do we do? How do you get recognized as a professional athlete? What do? You go to a combine. What do? They make you run. They make you jump, right? You have to be the biggest, buck in the room, right? The most athletic. Now, only thing is we have more high-paid slaves, right? And so I'm not knocking professional athlete because guess what? If I could have been one, I would have been one. Right? But now what we need to call upon them to do some things in our community. So it's not just one answer. I think it's all, it comes full circle. It comes full circle. So I think we got a lot of work to do, but I'm with a lot of people in this room. I think it's about the systemic racism that we have to break down. And I give kudos to those young people at Yale, not the black women who are leading the charge as they have always done. Right.
Yes.
Exactly. You know, always. But I also commend the folks at Yale that are standing with them. But I tell you what, Mike, I'm going to the game today. Right. Carrie, she's a graduate of Yale and she's very excited. But I would really be super happy if those kids decide, you know what? But it's not going to happen today. But I just thought it was a thought. But Yale and Harvard is going to be a great thing. But here's what I want to see. I want to see student athletes on these colleges do a couple of things. Number one, stand up for their rights, compensation being the first thing, but to stand toe to toe and side by side with their fellow students not living in this perceived bubble. And then the other thing is this. I would like to see more blue chip athletes start going back to HBCUs, right? And producing finances for them and allowing them to, not have to close their doors every other day. So I think we got a lot of work to do, and I will yield to the rest of the panel.
All right.
I just want to touch upon one thing that Kevin said about the HBCUs. I attended an HBCU, Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a product of New Haven, Connecticut, born and raised. So all my life I've been around people that look like me. And now in corporate America where I don't see too many people that look like me.
Mm.
And I myself am in a position of power. I have the power to hire and fire people. So I do try to hire people that look like me because even though it is a systemic problem, I think it does start by our one-on-one interaction, as the gentleman said. And I try very much so in my professional career and in my personal life to try to make sure that the images that white people see of me is not what they see on TV all the time.
Mm.
And I think a lot of times, and a lot of my friends don't like the fact that I say this, but I think a big responsibility lies within us because we help to perpetuate those stereotypes sometimes.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of times we don't want to agree to it, but it's the truth. You know, you're constantly on Facebook. I'm always seeing posts about, black people fighting one another and, the world star hip hop. I refuse to look at things like that. But we're people don't want to take accountability for the fact that we often do that. Now, that's not going to completely eradicate the images that white people see of us, but it's a start. So I try very hard with my friends and my professional relationships to make sure that the interactions they see of me are positive. They see a black person, a black woman, who's actually doing something with herself that has, you know, a formidable career. And it's just, I think it starts at home. And you can't completely eradicate it because racism is something that's learned, it's taught. So it is brought down generation to generation. So even if we do have those positive interactions with people of other cultures, I don't think we'll be completely able to eliminate it, but I think that that's a start with your one-on-one interactions with people and having conversations like this, but on a more personal level.
Mm-hmm. All right, Cliff.
Good morning, everyone. I don't know where to start. First, let me just thank YBC.
First, tell everybody who you are.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. Clifton Graves Jr. My father always made sure I used Jr. to distinguish the two of us. And I'm honored to bear his name. Clifton Graves Jr., I teach African-American history, by the way, at Gateway Community College, and I'll get to that in a minute, Jamal. But also I work as the program manager for this, Mayor Harp's Prison Reentry Program Project Fresh Start. So I deal with this issue on different levels. First, just a couple quick points. I want to thank YBC for having this forum, and I'm honored to and blessed to be in this forum with so many distinguished leaders in this community. I want to also to commend the students. My heart was lifted when I saw the students at Yale and students at Missouri, and there was a flashback to 30 years ago when I was a college student, and these kind of events were happening all the time. And I think it shows that history does bear studying, Jamal, in terms of understanding how things have evolved. And I do want to say this. One thing, and they know about this out in the initial interview, that it's important to understand, it is important to understand history and put your arms and grasp it, because for 500 years, I think the two words that I share with my classes that I think that symbolize and embody the spirit of the African-American struggle have been resistance and resilience. Resistance and resilience. Resistance and resilience. Through every century, from the first encounters with the Portuguese in the 1400s to yesterday, it's been resistance and resilience. And I think so we have to understand that. So when we see it on Yale's campus or seeing it in Missouri or seeing in the streets, I think it's important to understand, Jamal, your analysis, I think, is correct about systemic and structural racism, economic as well as social. But I do believe that if you study history, you'll see that as way back in the 1900s, Du Bois talked about that, and Robeson talked about that, and A. Philip Randolph talked about that. And so we have to understand and do our reading, understand that we aren't visiting, this is not new ground for us, new territory, but how we address it and adapt it to the new circumstances are important. I get back to that in a second, resilience and resistance. And also on a personal note, I too, like my brother and friend Yusuf, had to deal with my daughter, who grew up born in North Carolina, reared here in Connecticut, went to school here, went to graduate of Spelman College, stayed in the ATL for 10 years, and with different experiences, comes back to New Haven and finds a soulmate in an Italian-American from Middletown. I mean, go figure that. But as I looked at that, I thought about it like you know yourself did, because of my Afrocentric upbringing background, I think what we taught our children was to judge folks on an individual basis, how they treat you, how they deal with you, judge them as a person. I mean, that's what we taught our children. That's what we raised and reared.
That's right.
And so I think so the fact that that's happening, and the fact that she still knows who she is in terms of her spirit.
Exactly.
And has her whole sense of identity, I think I'm proud of. Just quickly, so I grew up, I'm like Apostle Brunson. I grew up in the South. You can still tell from my dialect, my accent. Grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And so I didn't have to read about it, didn't have to see videotapes of it, read it in the book. I drank from the colored water fountain. I went to the colored bathroom. I sat in the Jim Crow roost in the movie theaters where black people would only sit for the theaters. I went and had to go to the back of the restaurants to pick up takeout food because we couldn't sit in the restaurant. Sat in the buses, in the segregated parts of the bus. But the interesting thing about that community we grew up in was the fact that there was a college there, Winston-Salem State University, Big House Gaines, one, and others. And so we had a community that embodied both the spirit of Du Bois' Talent the 10th and also Booker T. Washington's Pull Yourself Up by the Bootstrap. So we had African-Americans who, in spite of those hostilities that we faced, and the fact that I had my great-uncle, my mom, my grandma's brother, was shot dead in the woods by a white hunter who thought he was a deer. And nobody was ever arrested, nobody ever charged. My cousin, who was like a brother to me, I grew up, was playing cards on the white side of town, got shot in the back with a shotgun. Body was put in the car and dropped on the street in the black side of town. Nobody is still arrested to this day and or charged. So you understand the hostility and the racism that you deal with, but to the credit of our community, that spirit of resilience was that, you know what, in spite of these things, you know, you can still do and be anything you want to be. So in that community, our family doctor was African-American. My optometrist, the eye doctor, was African-American. The dentist was African-American. The insurance company we bought insurance from was African-American. The bank where we deposited money into, the credit union, was run by African-Americans. So we had this sense of self-help and self-sufficiency that, hey, that you can be whatever you want to be and do whatever you want to do in spite of what they do, in spite of what they say. But understand and appreciate the fact you still have some structural inequalities and racism you have to deal with. Let me fast forward. So at 15, my family moves here to Connecticut. So I'm thinking, like most folks grew up in the South, it's Connecticut, it's the land of milk and honey. And this, you know, this everything's going to be fine up here. We'll be good. You know, we'll be treated as equals and treated fairly. So I'm shipped off to a prep school about 50 miles from here. Got a scholarship because at that time they were giving away scholarships to black people to fill up the slots. So I go to school and I'm a part of a class at the Gunnery Prep School, 13 African-American students out of 225. The largest class of African-Americans ever at that institution. And so most from Mississippi and Alabama, Virginia, and North Carolina, like myself. And so shortly after we're there, we start getting these notes in our mailboxes, end notes on our mailboxes, black people hanging from nooses on our mailboxes, on our dorm doors. And we're just looking, so those of us from the South saying, wait a minute, are we still in Virginia? Are we still in North Carolina? This is Connecticut, the liberal North, or as Malcolm used to say, the up South. and that's what became clear to us. It was up South. And as it turned out, to make a strong long story just quickly to cut to the chase, as it turns out, we're thinking there must have been some white students from Virginia, Mississippi, who they had recruited. It had to be them, because it couldn't have been these good northern students from Connecticut, New York, doing this. Well, as it turns out, we did a protest like the students are doing now, and the school did an investigation. They found out the ringleader of this group, which called themselves the Ku Klux Klan of the North, was the son of the president of Peter Paul Mounds and Almond Joy, located right here in Connecticut. His daddy was the president of the board. He also was president of the board of trustees for the school, which you know that, so you know that not much was done. He was his wrist was slapped. But what it said to us, it was a transformative experience, because then it opened our eyes that, oh, this racism is systemic. It's not just confined to the Virginias and the Carolinas and Mississippi. It is institutionalized in American culture. It's a part of the fabric, the rubric of this culture, that a young, wealthy, privileged white boy saw us as a threat. We just poor boys from the South, primarily. He saw us as a threat, and he felt infringed on by us. And so that set the tone for us, for me personally, and for the rest of us, as we moved through prep school, through college and law school, that, hey, you know what, this stuff is real, and stuff that has to be addressed in a very, 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 very strong and organized way. So that, by sharing that anecdotal story, it's important to understand as we fast forward to today and we look at these issues that are confronting us here in New Haven and Connecticut across the country. I think someone said earlier that I think Barack Obama has been the lightning rod, but I think as his administration comes to an end in about a year, I think it's been instructive for all of us to see that, and it's come to a head, I think, a lot in this administration, that if we didn't know it then, we know it now. That, again, having as wonderful as it was and a great experience it was to have this man of color in the White House, we understand what it did. It brought to a head that institutional racism, structural racism, and inequalities and injustice are an inherent part of the American economy, the American system, and that one person being in one place is going to turn that overnight. It's going to take us, all of us, to continue to attack it and address it at wherever it rears its ugly head. It's going to take all of us, no matter what nationality, ethnicity we come from, to understand and appreciate the fact that this struggle is, we, as I said to Roberto during the break, that I think John Oliver Killings wrote an article about 20 years ago that said, we cannot afford to be sprinters. We must be long-distance runners.
That's right.
May put it in your head, long-distance runners.
That's right.
We have to be long-distance runners in the struggle for racial and social and economic equality in this country. And with that in mind, we have to commit ourselves to that. We may not like it. May be distasteful that we have to deal with this stuff, but it is what it is. And I think once we take on that mantra and incorporate that into our being, then I think we can deal with this and address it and adapt it a little better. One last point, just if I can. Just Jamal's point about history. I teach this African American history class, and this is instructive about our-
You've
done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.